Wizard of Oz. We hear he is the Wizard of Wiz, if ever a Wiz there was. If ever, oh, ever a Wiz there was, the Wizard of Oz is one because of the wonderful things he does. We're off to see the Wizard, the wonderful Wizard of Oz.
This is The Wizards of Money, your money and financial management series, but with a twist. My name is Smithy and I'm a wizard watcher in the land of Oz. This is part 7 of the Wizards of Money series and it is entitled The Money Cycle versus the Water Cycle. In this 7th edition of Wizards, we're going to take a look at the very intimate and yet very troubled relationship between money and water. We will do this by first navigating our way through a simple model of money flows, which we shall call the money cycle. Then we'll circle through the water cycle and remind ourselves of all that stuff we learnt in elementary school, plus more of the stuff they didn't tell us about. Then we'll do something you don't see done very much. We'll highlight the link between money and water by identifying a point on both cycles where they are firmly fixed to each other, and where it's easy to see that what's good for one is normally pretty horrible for the other. Throughout this episode of Wizards, we'll be hearing some water cycle words of wisdom from Dr. Vandana Shiva, Indian scientist and activist, who gave a presentation at the Council of Canadians International Forum on Conservation and Human Rights in June this year. Dr. Shiva has a new book coming out called Water Wars, which is to be released in February of next year. The link between profiteering, corporate globalization, and damage to the water cycle should be fairly well known to most people. Coverage of such issues such as water contamination, salinization of water supplies, acid rain, ecological damage caused by dams have received widespread attention in recent years. And there is no doubt these phenomena are the result of human activities driven by economic pressures of paying interest on loans and meeting profit expectations of shareholders. That is, this damage has been a consequence of the pressures of contemporary capital and debt markets. Many realize that mainstream economics forgot to factor in the environment, and the economics must now change. What we'll focus on in this edition is how much such environmental destruction is actually built right into the fundamental building blocks of the monetary system and their associated capital markets. In fact, as we shall see, this link exists right at the point of money origination or money creation. The link between water and money was selected for this discussion in this episode of Wizards because all of us are made up of about 2/3 water. We can't live without water, and today water is our most troubled natural resource. Water is shaping up to be the biggest issue of the 21st century, so we had better understand very well how money works to disturb the water cycle. If this disturbance involves something fundamental to the mechanics of the monetary system, we had better know this too, so that we can think about, as we discussed in Wizards Part 6, designing more water-friendly monetary systems. Recall in Wizards Part 1 that we discussed how you and I don't just go out and make money when we go to work or sell something, because we're not banks and we don't have a banking license. Instead, we are just getting a transfer of already existing money from people that have some. Unless these people or companies are a bank, then they didn't make money either. They also got a transfer of some money that already existed. Money, you will recall from Wizards Part 1, is just the other side, the mirror image of debt. Money is created by the creation of a corresponding amount of debt. Money, in its most basic and spendable or liquid form, is created by banks making loans to the non-bank public. As we discussed in Wizards Part 1, banks make money up out of thin air by making a loan to a borrower, which also becomes a deposit or money to the recipient of these funds, let's say the seller of a house, for example. So this means that when you come by some money, say from your paycheck or by selling some furniture at your yard sale, this money has already been through some kind of journey to get to you. But at some time, maybe last week or maybe 50 years ago, it started off as a bank loan or a bank or Federal Reserve purchase of some asset. Then it has travelled through many different human interactions of trade to get to you. It may have even travelled overseas and come back again. It is interesting to think about the history of any money we might come by. Maybe the money you're getting today started its life for some purpose you think is quite good. But maybe it started its life as funding for a dam or mining project, and here you are with it today. Maybe it even started off as funding for that logging project that caused your favourite forest to be clear-cut and which caused you so much distress. That seems like money that some of us might not like very much. So we better have a look at exactly what purposes money is being created for, and then we'll have a better idea of the history of the money we are condoning and accepting today. This is quite easy to do in a few simple steps. I've listed the details of these three steps on the Wizards of Money website. The Wizards of Money website is located at www.wizardsofmoney.org. If you care to follow through these three steps, you will go and visit the website of the Federal Reserve and also the FDIC, or the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. If you follow these steps, you will be looking at some tables of data that show you how the money we use today was actually created and for what purpose it was created. Combining all this information, you will see that over half of the money created by banks comes into existence for some kind of real estate transaction, commercial or industrial project. We can extrapolate that and say that about half the money we use today came into existence for the purpose of some kind of alteration to natural land and its associated natural resources. So we see that the US dollar-based monetary system as we know it today is heavily dependent for its survival on human alteration of the natural landscape. This provides the key link between money and water.
Standing here, the old man said to me, long before these crowded streets, here stood my dreaming tree. Below it he would sit for hours at a time. Now progress takes away what forever took to find, and now is falling hard. He feels the falling dark, how he longs to be beneath his dreaming tree. Conquered fear to climb, a moment froze in time, when the girl who first he kissed promised him she'd be his. Remember mother's words, there beneath the tree, no matter what the world, you'll always be my baby. Mommy, come quick, the dreaming tree has died, the air is growing thick, the fear it cannot hide, the dreaming tree has died.
Let us build a simple model of the money cycle in our heads for the purposes of discussion. The Wizards of Money website at wizardsofmoney.org has a diagrammatic representation of the money cycle we are about to discuss. Similarly, it has a diagram of the water cycle and of this critical link between the two cycles. Here's our simple model. Let's suppose in our simple model that all money is created as real estate loans, either for developers who initially build houses, offices and shopping centres, or for those who end up buying these buildings. Then money cycles around the economy as follows. Suppose a bank loan first gets made to a developer of 100 units of money. A unit could be, say, $1,000 or $10,000, but For simplicity, we're just going to talk about money in units. The bank loan gets created as 100 units, and the developer can use this 100 units to go out and develop land. This creates a new 100 units of money in the monetary system. The developer then develops the land enough so that they can sell it at a high enough price that they can both pay the interest of, say, 10 units on that loan back to the bank, as well as make a profit for their shareholders, which is, say, another 10 units. This means that the developer needs to sell the developed land for 120 units of money. This need to return both interest to the banks and a profit to the developer's shareholders encourages development above and beyond what would result in a zero-interest monetary system. This is similar to those systems that we spoke about in Wizards Part 6. Let's say that the developer spent the 100 units of money he borrowed on some workers to clear the land and at the brick store to buy the bricks for the house. Let's say that both the workers and the brick store owner spent all their money, which is 100 units in total, at the snazzy furniture store at the local mall. Snazzy then puts this 100 units in its checking account at the same bank, and everything balances. The developer sells the house to a buyer, which is you, for 120 units of money. You borrow this full amount of money from the bank in order to buy the house. This money gets put into the developer's checking account. The developer then pays back their 110 to the bank, which is the original 100 unit loan plus 10 units of interest. The bank makes 10 units in profits, which it then distributes to its shareholders, and the developer makes 10 units in profits, which it also distributes to its shareholders. These shareholders then spend all their money at the snazzy furniture store, which is very popular these days. This is also the store where you work as a salesperson. So at this point, bank loans total 120 units to you, and there is also 120 units in checking account money floating around in the economy, which has all purchased goods at the snazzy furniture store and is accounted for in Snazzy's checking account. Well, over the next few years, you will earn this 120 units from your job at the snazzy furniture store and will be able to pay off your loan. Oh, well, sort of. Let's not forget that you need to pay interest to the bank as well. So more money must be coming into the system from other places that will enable you to get the total money you need to pay off the loan plus interest. To keep everything flowing, enough money must be coming in or being created to enable most people access to enough money to pay off their loans. This is not true for all people, as a certain amount of bankruptcies are built into the system. But you don't want too many bankruptcies or even just a few big bankruptcies, as this would threaten the confidence in the system, which would collapse it. Well, all this means a constant supply of new money must be continuously created, and especially as others are paying off their bank loans and thus making money disappear. Recall that in our simple model, we assume that all money is being created by direct land development or alteration. But in the real world, it's more like half, though much of the other half is indirectly related to land alteration. So this means more real estate development or land alteration is needed to create this money to keep things flowing smoothly and to keep confidence in it and to keep it from collapsing. In a way then, the money machine is sort of eating up land for its own survival. The survival of the monetary system as we know it today depends on land alteration, which in turn disturbs the water cycle. But whatever is this going to mean for the water cycle? Surely the humans need water more than they need money. We're going to take the market to meet real efficiency in the form of Mother Nature's water cycle. To start off this section, here are some excerpts from Dr. Vandana Shiva's water speech that remind us first about our relationship to water, and second, remind us of some simple truths about the water cycle.
You know, I was sitting there and listening to the wonderful friends and speakers of tonight and thinking, the global economy and that movement of fictitious money actually disintegrates, excludes, and renders entire species and peoples dispensable. But there is one thing that ties us together as a world community, and that is the water cycle. Maybe the snow up on these peaks was evaporation from the Indian Ocean. Some drop somewhere. And it's that connection that they can't chop up, no matter how much they decide that they own water, and they'll get concessions like they got concessions for minerals, and they made maps to own territories. Water is so elusive, it's going to join us in not being controlled. We are seeing, I believe, we're going to see this clash in the next, I believe in the next 5 years we'll have the decisive period about whether the commercial market logic of global corporations will work, or whether the earth logic of the sustenance of life, including our lives, will work. There are, of course, brilliant people who think that the big question for water is whether Adam Smith's invisible hand will be unshackled. If progress toward increased reliance on markets, described in a book on water privatization, continues, supplies of water will increase as users trade and with one another, and consumption will be tamed by higher prices. Now, they've got every fact of that wrong. Supplies of water don't increase no matter how much you trade. They stay the same water cycle. They didn't get that simple literacy. I think what we need to do for the water privatizers is simple lessons that we learn in grade 4 on the hydrological cycle.
On the first topic in this speech of how the water cycle links us together over space, we must also remember that the water cycle links us together over time. And that it doesn't just link humans together, it links together all life on Earth. Sometimes I like to look at a glass of water and ponder whether some of the molecules might have been sweated out by dinosaurs millions of years ago, and a few others might have been used to refresh a weary statue carrier on Easter Island a couple of thousand years ago. Whatever we do to the water cycle today, our dirty fingerprints will be all over whatever the water cycle becomes for future generations. Furthermore, the water cycle is so complex, it is such an intricate piece of Mother Nature's handiwork that we barely even understand it. We are still and always will be learning more about it. So we can't possibly know the consequences of significant human alteration to the water cycle. As we know from our grade 4 classes, water evaporates from the ocean, lakes, rivers, and is sweated out by plants and goes to the sky as a gas. Later it falls as rain or snow, gets used by plants and animals, including the humans, and then goes running down hills and mountains to the rivers and to the sea to start the cycle all over again. Of course, this is a huge oversimplification of the water cycle suitable for a fourth grader, but it doesn't much help us grown-ups see all the links between money creation, land alteration, and water cycle disturbance. Let's consider some other parts of the water cycle that will help us understand this. Nature has figured out some excellent ways to moderate the flow of water, to manage flood and drought risk, and also to clean water so that the waste of one process can get all cleaned up and ready for another process. This all happens through water's interaction with the land and with the ultimate central banker, the central banker of energy known as the sun. Humans have absolutely no control over the energy central banker. All they can control is the things that store the sun's energy, like plants and animals that eat plants, and also they can go to find the sources of other stored solar energy in the form of old squashed dead plants and animals, which we call oil and coal. All these activities, plus all of the human monetary system driven development of land, affect the land on Earth, not the energy central banker. So the land is what we focus on in considering the link between the water cycle and the money cycle that forms the basis of our economy. The way that nature manages flood and drought risk is really through plants and soils, which are, of course, the very best of friends. The soils being largely made up of decaying leaves and trees, and the plants needing the soils for food. The soils store lots of the rain as groundwater, and they are kept in place by tree roots. Some of this water the trees might like for later when they get a bit thirsty, and other groundwater might fall to an underground aquifer or run off slowly into a stream in the watershed. Having lots of plants and rich soils in a watershed means that when there is lots of rain, the ground will soak up lots of the excess water, and this will help mitigate flood risk. When it's been a long time between rains, you can rely on the groundwater in the aquifer or the groundwater gradually seeping into a nearby stream to provide a steady flow of water from the earlier rains. This helps mitigate drought risk in the natural cycle. As for nature's water cleansing functions, the trees keeping the soils in place prevent excessive amounts of mud, clay, sand, and salt from sliding into the nearby streams. The soils and the little microorganisms living in them are very fond of waste products that most other living things would find rather unappetizing. Them and other little critters living near or in the stream often perform water cleaning and filtering functions that help to make the water usable for others. The trees sweat off some water through evapotranspiration, helping to cool the stream area so that all the critters that live there that have an important role in the water cycle can stay at a nice temperature to do all their work. Having such a water cycle on our planet makes a lot of sense, given that gravity would otherwise drain all the water to the salty sea, and seawater is not very drinkable. This whole business of evaporation and rainfall to replenish all living things that need fresh water is quite sensible, and of course, life as we know it would not exist without an efficient water cycle. A prosperous human society cannot exist without an efficient water cycle. There's that efficiency word that people would have us believe that only markets can provide. Let's have a look at this. When the laissez-faire marketeers go on about efficiency of the market, they are talking about what they label as Pareto efficiency. This is a sort of ideal allocation of resources amongst societal members that matches supply to demand within a given set of parameters set by a society via the governmental body of the imagined democracy. But that sounds all very confusing, doesn't it? Let's just talk about efficiency in plain language that makes sense intuitively. At the end of the day, markets and the monetary system are all about allocating energy amongst different participants of society. Whether that energy be in the form of labour applied to a raw good to make it into a product, or the raw good itself, such as food crops, or stored energy such as coal and oil. And we know that almost all our energy ultimately comes from the sun, and that only plants know how to store that energy directly. All these being the processes of Mother Nature, they obey what we humans have interpreted to be the natural laws of physics. Most especially, they obey two important energy laws, the first and second laws of thermodynamics, that have never ever found to have been violated by any process. Water obeys these natural laws. Money, being a purely human abstraction, does not. Those put off by what sounds to be complex laws invented by physicists should not be deterred, for these are simple to understand laws of nature that get right to the heart of the conflict between man and nature, and specifically to the conflict between money and water. The first law of thermodynamics is a law of conservation of energy. This says that the amount of energy in the universe is fixed, and you can't create new energy or destroy existing energy. When it comes to the planet Earth, we get new energy to the Earth from another source in the universe called the Sun. Apart from all the energy that we have stored in and on Earth and the daily dose of sunlight, we have no other energy available to us. This is perhaps the primary reason humans have seen fit to develop markets, that is, to allocate the scarce resource of energy. If the laws of thermodynamics had just stopped there, my, what a peaceful world we would have. Under the conservation of energy, I could just fill up my car with gas, stick a little collector in the exhaust pipe, and recycle all the energy I just used and fill my car back up, since I know that energy will be conserved. I'd only ever have to buy one tank of gas in my life. I'd only have to buy one load of electricity to heat my home for my whole life. I just recycle everything over and over. Energy companies would go bankrupt, there would be no wars in the Middle East, and the stock market would collapse because no one could make money from selling energy. Okay, there is a catch, and that's the very important second law of thermodynamics. This is the entropy law, the law that sits right at the heart of the conflict between man and nature. Entropy is a measure of disorder. We shall talk about entropy in terms of the usefulness of energy. Low entropy means very useful energy. High entropy means quite useless energy. Like, you can't use it, you can't really use it for another process because it's not organized enough. The second law of thermodynamics says that entropy always increases as energy is used. Therefore, once you have used all the gas in your tank, even though the driving process left the same amount of energy from the gas in the world, that energy has become pretty useless so that you can't reuse it. This law then really creates the scarcity of energy and the primary motivation for using markets to allocate it. The economists tell us that this will be done most efficiently if the conditions of a free market are met. Presumably this means energy will be distributed more efficiently, since that ultimately is what the market is distributing. So how does the market deal with the entropy law, or the second law of thermodynamics? The answer to that would be, well, not at all. While it is true that the entropy law contributes greatly to the scarcity that gives rise to the need for markets, you will not find the entropy law mentioned in mainstream economics textbooks. Modern money and capital markets and contemporary economics have been built up ignoring the most fundamental laws of nature. When it comes to the water cycle, it is interesting to consider who runs things most efficiently. Is it the markets or is it Mother Nature? Given that the most desirable outcome of the water cycle, even from a human-centered point of view, is a stable, secure flow of clean water, one would have to conclude that Mother Nature arranges the most efficient allocation of energy. For, in the natural process, there are no waste products, and solar energy is used to its maximum. Every player in the natural water cycle does some work in the water cycle and various related nutrient cycles, and their waste products get used as input into some other process in these cycles. Nothing is wasted and everything fits together to form a whole water cycle that has evolved over millions of years and that we are the beneficiaries of today. Nature's water cycle seems to have taken the entropy law into consideration and then optimized the energy used within this boundary condition. Now enter the humans and their crazy monetary system. The humans come along with their fears of scarcity, markets, and monetary system that ultimately depends on alteration of the land for its survival and for the survival of the markets. but most alterations to the natural landscape then disturb Mother Nature's maximally energy-efficient water cycle in several common ways. Here are some common things that have happened to the water cycle all across the globe. First, deforestation exposes soils and causes soils, sediment and salt to rush into the stream at the next rainfall. You end up with salty water and/or sediment that kills off lots of the plants and critters that had important roles in the water cycle, such as water filtration. Second, the loss of soil and vegetation coupled with impervious or hard surface coverage such as roads, car parks and buildings means that water can no longer seep into the ground, as is very important in mitigating flood and drought risk. The frequency of flood and drought increases, as we've seen in recent years. Third, human activity in watersheds such as real estate, mining, logging, intense farming, and so forth, and the loss of filtering systems through the loss of vegetation and soils means more and more pollutants are entering the water sources. Fourth, the practice of building dams, either for hydropower or for storing water in a place that doesn't have enough, and the practice of channeling water to places that don't have much, has been responsible for massive loss of aquatic life, flooding, and drastic alteration to affected watersheds and local water cycles. Then the market-oriented humans come along and say, well, now we have a water problem. Let's use some market mechanisms to fix it. In fact, a lot of the market-oriented people go so far as to say, well, let's privatise water. That pure market solution will fix everything. And they say this perhaps forgetting that it was market forces that got us into this problem in the first place. At this point, it's worth hearing some more water words of wisdom from Dr. Vandana Shiva's Canadian Water Speech, and we'll hear about human alteration of land and saving the water cycle, and also about water freedom.
I had my first wake-up call on the water crisis in 1974, 27 years ago. I was coming to this country to do a PhD in quantum theory, and I wanted to carry with me some of my fondest experiences and pleasures. So I went back to do what I love to do, swim in my favorite Himalayan stream, except that it had disappeared meantime. And it disappeared because the oak forests that fed it had been chopped down for development to plant apple orchards. They never got good apples because the oak forest used to create the microclimate to create good rain, and once they got rid of it, they didn't ever have the right climate for the apples. Well, I started to look out for the movement that was starting to spread to save the Himalayan rivers, streams and forests, the movement called CHIPCO, which became literally my ecological university. That's where I learned all my ecology. And I remember the songs that still inspire me. It's middle of the night, the tunes come back. Save these forests of rhododendron and oak. They give us life. They give us cool water in their roots. The oak gives us milk from the leaves because the women feed the cattle the tender leaves of fodder. And the roots give us water. CHIPCO used to be laughed at. I remember the decades, you know, from 74 to 78, everyone used to say, ha ha ha, what a slogan, forests give us water. How stupid can people get? Forests give us revenue in timber. And then we had this massive flood of 1978, when an entire mountain fell into the river Ganges because of deforestation, created a lake of 4 miles long, and when it burst, there was a flood all the way to Calcutta. That day, the government got the point. They realized the commercial logic of logging did not make sense in terms of the value of forests in watersheds, that water was the primary yield of natural forests, and not the timber, and not the profits, and not the revenues. In 1982, our ministry called me in to study the impact of mining in Dehradun. I was at that time in Bangalore, and of course I wasn't going to say no to this one. It was home. And We worked with local communities. The terms of, you know how with government contracts, they give you terms of reference. And the terms of reference was the destruction of the green cover of the mountains, to study the impact of the destruction of the green cover. The miners were very smart. They went and painted the mines overnight green. But since I do my work with communities, it was the women who said, no, the issue is the water. Because this was limestone, it's an aquifer, that's where the 4,000 millimeters we receive is stored to feed our springs and streams. 1982, I saw our last perennial stream go dry in the summertime. And we worked with every means in our hands. The village women did direct action. They blocked the bulldozers, they blocked the roads. We took the case to Supreme Court on the basis of our study. And that became the first case where, because of water destruction, a commercial activity was stopped. The courts ruled that when commerce starts to threaten life, commerce must go, not life. And when they talk about consumption being tamed by higher prices, they also got it wrong. Because when you have the levels of inequality in the world and within countries that we do, someone can always fill a swimming pool, water a lawn, irrigate a golf club, wash a car for the water that someone needed for drinking and growing a crop. And because they didn't get their notions of freedom and value sorted out appropriately, because you can be free. You know, a river is free if it flows wild. That's real free trade in water. The river to follow its own logic and take it according to its ecological integrity. People are free when they have access to water, safe water, water for which women don't have to walk 30 miles. Water is not free if it's priced. That is when it stops being free. And in terms of value, putting a price on water doesn't give it value, it robs it of value. Because the real value of water is its spiritual value of being the very foundation of life. And every society, every culture, the one thing you can open the Quran and you can open the Vedas and you can open the Bible. And one thing all of them teach us, and all the indigenous cultures, they tell you to have reverence for water, because water is the basis of life. One of the moral imperatives that's been created for you to export water is being told they're water-poor regions. Now, you know, the state of Rajasthan is the most inspiring state for me in water terms just now. Because in that state, everyone has a water conservation system in their homes. And if today people have water, it's because those systems are still alive. Those amazing forts and fortresses and tanks. And what they maintain is not a market in water. What they maintain is the right order for water. And they call it Voj, which means composition, system, solution, but it also means competence, and most important, a humility with respect to the powers and forces of nature and the limits it sets on our life. And bending to those limits, the people of Rajasthan have reactivated river after river in the last decade. Aravari came alive in 1994 through local water conservation works. The Ruparel River came alive in 1995. This is investment of love, of care, of labor. It is not investment of finance.
So are these market solutions that we've been talking about as efficient as Mother Nature's way of managing and distributing water? I think not, because there is obvious waste in these market solutions. For example, in order to clean water that has been polluted by human activities, some electricity is needed, and this is extra energy that is simply not needed in the natural process. Not only is extra energy needed, but there are waste products produced by the human process, such as extra water treatment chemicals, that cannot be readily absorbed by natural processes, and so create waste. Add to this the fact that human alteration of land has increased flood risk and drought risk that then gets adjusted for by all these human constructions, such as holding ponds, gutters, and so forth, adding more and more energy input into the water cycle. That is in turn further disturbing the water cycle through channelizing flow, which causes things like stream bank erosion, and the list goes on and on. Surely it would be hard to argue that markets can run the water cycle, that cycle responsible for the stuff of life we so depend on, more efficiently than Mother Nature can. Nature has had the opportunity to develop a most energy-efficient water cycle millions more years than humans have, and we are, after all, creatures of nature ourselves. All this is not to say that humans should not have markets for other things or should not alter the land. Rather, it is to say that humans might build a much better world and more efficient use of energy if they just left the water cycle up to the master of it. Ultimately, this would mean a paradigm shift in the way land is developed so as to retain enough natural features in every watershed to retain nature's energy-efficient control over the water cycle. Ideally, this need to retain essential natural functions would enter into the economy at the point of credit creation, or equivalently, money origination.
In 1984, the Planning Commission of India asked me to work with them on why the water sources of Maharashtra Strait were disappearing. Why was every village becoming what is called a no-source village? Why were the wells drying up? Why did people have no drinking water? Why was the biggest expenditure of government bringing water in tankers from miles away? So I went to Maharashtra, traveled for a while, got out all the old documents, and didn't take very long to figure out why there was a crisis in 1984. Because 1972, Maharashtra had had a drought. And a drought meant there was a drinking water problem. At that point, most of our water came from wells. And the government wanted a small World Bank loan to deepen the wells so that people could have drinking water. The World Bank said, no, we'll give you a loan to shift from coarse grains, as they call them, which are highly nutritious, water-prudent millets, and to shift to sugarcane farming because it's more commercially viable. And you know how the World Bank works. It gives you a loan, and its only logic is a return on investment logic. That means for everything they give, there must be a return on investments. People feeding themselves on millets and conserving their water doesn't generate investment returns to the bank. So they forced an entire water deficit state, a state which gets 600 millimeters in a very hard rock area of the Deccan Trap, of which only 10% filters through. And you can imagine, out of 600, 10% going means only 60 millimeters a year is available in a renewable way. And in that, they want to grow sugarcane that requires 1,200 millimeters of rainfall. Sugarcane covers only 2% of the area in Maharashtra, but you started to use up 80% of the water. And no wonder you had a water famine within a decade. Same was the case with Gujarat. The World Bank gave water loans and said, drill deep tube wells. Today, in the state of Gujarat, and last year I traveled through during the peak of the drought, tube wells are down to 2,000 feet. 2,000 feet. And as a child, I remember the landscape of India, water everywhere at 5 feet and 10 feet. Now, if you know India, it's a peninsula, and all the water drains to the coast. The coasts are one area where till 5-6 years ago, you could literally scrape the sand, and the amazing filtration of the coastline will give you fresh water at 2 feet. Well, the World Bank managed to finance the destruction of our coastal aquifers too. They gave a loan to start industrial shrimp farming. The industrial shrimp farming left the entire coastline a salt-laden, polluted desert. And it's the women who had to walk for miles for water who called me in to join them in their struggle. They started to break down these tanks and shrimp ponds. We managed in that case too to get the Supreme Court to order the closure of these mines. But for every victory we have, they try and take us backwards. They're now trying to undo the laws that allow the environmental laws for coastal protection that allowed us to pay. Protect the coastal water systems. They're trying to undo the tribal laws that prevent forest land from going into non-forest use and away from tribal ownership. That's all the trade treaties are about. They're about undoing our national constitutions, our national laws that have been guarantees for the sustenance and survival of people in their homes and their homelands. We are seeing, I believe, we're going to see this clash in the next, I believe in the next 5 years we'll have the decisive period about whether the commercial market logic of global corporations will work or whether the earth logic of the sustenance of life, including our lives, will work.
Now let's talk about banks, land and water. So what are the banks and other financial institutions doing about all this? In fact, it's not just the private financial institutions who should be paying attention, it's also their regulators and the central banks. On this latter point, it is interesting to study the composition of the boards of directors of the 12 regional Federal Reserve banks in the United States to see what industries and activities might have the most influence over central banking practices. Interestingly, the highest concentration of representation outside of the bank sector are from real estate and development industries and from the energy and transportation industries. This is consistent with our earlier observations of what activities really drive the monetary system and the creation of money. You can find a listing of these directors online at the Federal Reserve's website at www.federalreserve.gov. And you can go to the general info and find the list of directors' web pages. Let us turn our attention to the largest banking conglomerate of all, Citigroup. What are they doing about all these environmental problems? Well, on September 28, 2001, Citigroup issued a press release entitled, quote, Citigroup selected as component of Dow Jones Sustainability World Indexes, end quote. The release goes on to say that, quote, companies included in the Dow Jones Sustainability Index are leading their industries by setting standards for best practices and demonstrating superior environmental, social and economic performance, end quote. The article goes on to mention that Citigroup serves on the steering committee of the United Nations Environment Programme, or UNEP, and that Citigroup seeks to, quote, manage potential environmental issues and find financial value in environmentally sound business transactions, end quote. Their statements in this press release are somewhat at odds with their funding of environmentally destructive projects as documented by the City Action Activist Group, which is a project of the Rainforest Action Network and various other NGOs. And these projects are documented at cityaction.org. Citigroup and other large international financial conglomerates have been fairly active in UNEP's Financial Initiatives Group, established in 1997. You can find more information about this United Nations group at unepfi.net. The Swiss Bankers Association has also come out with some very nice statements about doing business in an environmentally friendly manner. While all these nice words from the banking sector might make some sleep more soundly at night, others might be concerned about leaving monetary system reform up to the bankers themselves, especially since land alteration pressures lie right at the heart of the foundations of our mainstream monetary system. Unfortunately, the approach of the concerned bankers and the various finance initiatives groups has been to see everything through profit and money-tinted glasses. They think of environmental problems in terms of dollar cost and often think of solutions in terms of getting more profits in monetary terms. Thus, much work in the field of sustainable economics often gets reduced to converting all natural processes into monetary equivalents. Continuation of this practice could very well lead to a situation where economic sustainability looks great on paper in terms of long-term sustainable profits, but completely misses the prediction of, say, catastrophic alteration to the water cycle, increasing flood, drought, and contamination risks. To move from contemporary economics, which has historically ignored all natural destruction, and to a more ecologically sensitive ecological economics, we must move away from the practice of converting anything and everything to dollar terms in order to analyse them. The necessity for this can be seen in the observation that money is an abstract human invention that doesn't obey natural laws, but nature does. For example, when it comes to water, the primary measure for analysis should be water indicators, let's say probability of flood, probability of drought, or some kind of contamination risk, but the measure should not be money. We can also use energy itself as an indicator, since distribution of energy is so much of what our markets are really about. After such analysis, and given that nature is the most efficient user of energy, shouldn't we use natural solutions, such as preservation, conservation, and smart design, to complement and mitigate the effects of human development rather than energy-intensive human mitigation efforts? Having established the right balance between human development and natural land features, based on purely environmental indicators, we can then bring money into the picture based on environmental constraints that comply with natural laws and not the other way around, which is what happens today. This approach finally would constrain the monetary system to recognizing the laws of nature, which it has never done before. Finally, money would begin to respect the entropy law, or the second law of thermodynamics. In summary, this would result in fundamental changes to the monetary system itself right at the point of money origination. This is a much more radical approach than proposed by any of the finance industry-dominated groups such as the United Nations Environment Programme Finance Initiatives Group. But this more radical approach does seem necessary. And that's all for Wizards of Money Part 7. Note that the Wizards of Money has a website at wizardsofmoney.org where you can find the text of all episodes, plus some more references and other information.
From